This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just before the break, we heard the story of Benjamin Nugent. He's one person whose behavior put him on the cusp of an Asperger's syndrome diagnosis. Turns out later he says he didn't have it. And we're talking about it because his story tells us a little bit about a new move to narrow the definition of the autism spectrum. An expert panel is recommending that the very definition of the disease that's currently found in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, that's the sort of Bible of mental health published by the American Psychiatric Association, they're saying we should change the definition of autism.
And those changes could end up excluding lots of people who are now diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome and other milder forms of autism. It's a potentially huge shift that could mean a big set of consequences.
So, listeners, what do you think about a new, narrower definition of autism? What impact would that have on your family, your kids, and the services they could receive? Or did the definition of autism get too broad and too vague in the past, and maybe this is a needed correction? Or might some children who need help end up losing out? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALKED. We're joined now on the line by Dr. Catherine Lord. She is one of the members of the DSM-5, that's the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the task force which has been working on the new criteria for autism. She's also the director of the Institute for Brain Development, which is a joint project of New York Presbyterian Hospital, the Weill Medical College at Cornell, and Columbia Medical Center. Dr. Lord, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in the studio is Elise Levine Kanji. She's a member of the Westboro School Committee. Her son, Sam, is a teenager with autism, and she recently wrote an article for WBUR's Common Health about these possible changes. That's the Common Health blog. Elise, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me also.
Dr. Lord, let me first ask you, so can you just sort of briefly walk us through the proposed changes to the definition or the diagnostic definition of autism that we may see in the DSM-5?
Well, the goal of the proposed changes is not at all to exclude people. The goal is really to do a better job than DSM-4 did in terms of defining what it is that ASD is and that what clinicians who give this diagnosis mean.
And ASD, I'm sorry to interrupt, but ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder.
Yes, okay. It's Autism Spectrum Disorder. So the idea is not to narrow the definition of people who have ASD, but to be more accurate in how we describe it.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at what's currently in the DSM-4, which at this point in time is about 17 years old. It's not, you know, every year that it gets updated. And the proposed revisions, and I take your point that the revisions are aiming to be more specific. So walk us through some of those specifics. What's the difference?
Right. Well, one of the things is that there are many different subcategories of what are called pervasive developmental disorders in DSM-4. And what we propose to do in DSM-5 is to have one large category, which is autism spectrum disorder. And that category would encompass what is currently called autism, Asperger's syndrome, PDD-NOS, kids who have Rett syndrome and autistic behaviors, kids who have Fragile X and autistic behaviors. So the idea is to say, look, at this point, this is a behavioral diagnosis of a neurobiological condition, and we're not going to separate out kids by different genetic disorders. But also, we're not going to separate out kids within the category by things like language level or onset, but rather have those specified in addition to the diagnosis. You would have an autism spectrum disorder, and then you could have it with Rett syndrome. You could have an autism spectrum disorder and have high intelligence and no language delay, which might be equivalent to what is now called Asperger's syndrome, or autism spectrum disorder with severe intellectual impairment and very limited language. So the idea is that the disorder is broader, actually, but then with additional specifiers to better identify the strengths and weaknesses of individuals.
Well, let me ask you
so
about
that's
that.
That's a major change.
Oh, that's a major change. Okay, because I'm looking at the proposed revision here, and there's some things that strike me about it. One is that, as you were saying, it looks at two categories. One is that, you know, deficits in social communication and interaction, and the other is repeated restricted patterns of behavior. And below that, it's quite specific. I mean, it says in terms of deficits in social communication, the proposed revision says potential sufferers must manifest three or all three of the following. That's, you know, social or lack of social reciprocity, deficits in nonverbal communicative behaviors, and then difficulty maintaining relationships. It's more specific than that. But what I gather from saying that you have to have all three of the following is that now the DSM is going to look for things that are observable or measurable in a more precise way than perhaps the previous criteria had before.
Well, the idea is that we are trying to define the principles. For example, in social communication, there are those three principles that have to do with social reciprocity, verbal and nonverbal communication, and relationships and adjusting behavior to context. And what we've done is we've provided a whole series of examples which are not intended to be exhaustive. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that a clinician would say, look, I'm looking at a toddler here. What is an example of the kinds of relationships or adjusting to context that I would expect to see in a toddler? And those are not the same kinds of things that you would expect to see, for example, in a very articulate, intelligent adult. So we're actually, there are many examples listed, not intended to be all of the examples. We're really trying to say to clinicians, here are the principles. Someone does have to have difficulties in each of these areas, but you can pick your example on the basis of what how autism is expected to be manifested at that age and that language level and that developmental level.
Okay, Dr. Lohr,
from DSM-4.
That's different. Okay, so stand by for a second because I do want to bring Elise Levine Kanji back into this conversation. Elise, what's your first response to these proposed changes? We hear Dr. Lohr saying that it's actually going to be more exhaustive, the examples that are going to be in the DSM for doctors to use, but some people look at that as, you know, a good thing, and others say still see a somewhat narrowing of autism, the autism spectrum here.
Thanks, Meghna. Just before I start, I'd like to just respond. I know that you had Benjamin Nugent on at the beginning of the hour, and I really see his case as an anomaly, mm-hmm. that he was diagnosed by his mother. I think we all have friends in medical school whose main complaint is that all of a sudden they're in medical school and they're learning about some disease of the arm, and all of a sudden their arm is hurting, and sure enough, they're sure that they have some problem with their arm. So,
well, just to be fair to him, though, his mother was a professor of psychology.
And did she have any specialty in autism? And I think, my son went to a neurologist. The majority, all kids who have a diagnosis of autism and get it from a neurologist. And, I mean, my son was, you know, there was symptoms at 26 months. It wasn't that at 17, right. I was looking on the internet doing some research and deciding that my son had some illness.
Well, Lisa, I want you to continue your thought, but just to be fair, the reason why we brought Benjamin's example to the table is that it seems like a lot of people who sort of fall into that high-functioning Asperger's area of the autism spectrum are the ones who are most concerned about these proposed changes in the DSM. There was a time where at least he was thought to be amongst that group. So that's why we brought him, his story in to this conversation. But please do let me know what you think about the proposed changes.
Also, thank you very much. So Dr. Volkmer, who was part of the task force with Dr. Lord on looking at the changes to the autism diagnosis. He is the director of the Yale University Child Study Center at Yale School of Medicine. He's the primary author of the DSM-4. He's stated that he is absolutely against these new proposed changes because 55% of the current population who is diagnosed as autism spectrum disorder will be excluded. He's under the new proposal. I know that Dr. Lord disagrees with that, but he's certainly a man of extremely sound reputation and who's put his reputation on the line challenging this new definition.
Dr. Lord, go ahead.
He has, but I think that the context is really much more complicated, and his statements are really exaggerated. So in the first case, what he did was he took the DSM-4 field trials data, which I was involved in, which involve a checklist of the DSM-4 criteria, and he tried to match them up to the DSM-5 criteria. But the reality is the whole point of DSM-5 is to have, again, examples that are not exhaustive and to include many more things but they have to be examples of the principles. So, for example, in repetitive behaviors now, DSM-5 includes stereotypic language. It includes sensory abnormalities. It includes unusual response to change, which are not in DSM-4. Mm. So when he said that people couldn't meet DSM-5 criteria on the basis of his data, the data are not there.
Dr. Lord, let me jump back in here because I hear your passion regarding the precision and interpretation of the data. I'm afraid we don't have enough time to go into that in exquisite detail. There are some sort of underlying questions that I would like to get to about the impact that whatever the revision will be in DSM-5 may have on people, on families. And I'm going to get to that. But first, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join us, many people who care about this. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We are talking about proposed changes to the definition of autism in the DSM-5, which is going to come out in the next couple of years. Let's start in Worcester. Patrick's on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Patrick.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What's your thought?
I'm actually on the way home from Boston, from Children's Hospital, with my daughter who is on the autism spectrum. And she's on the other end of the spectrum. She's on the most severe type of autism called Rett syndrome. And our families have been concerned about this upcoming redefinition of autism on the short term, not on the long term. We're wondering about gaps in services that'll happen, maybe not in Massachusetts where we live, but in other states where, it's not as well serviced. If we get dropped off of the autism spectrum, we're concerned that there's going to be a service gap, which could be really devastating for families that need constant assistance and care.
Because by receiving a diagnosis of being on the spectrum, that makes your child eligible for all sorts of assistance and service in Massachusetts. Patrick, I take your point. We want to get to it, but let's get another call in here. Maybe along those lines, Leslie is calling from Lexington. You're on the air, Leslie.
Hi. This whole thing is so frustrating to me. I have a son on the spectrum. Actually, most people would say he's not anymore. But he was classically autistic at a year old and received massive services. He is a textbook case of why early intervention works. It just breaks my heart that people use anecdotal stories like the one earlier about that boy and what his mother did with the video and everything, and then are using that to inform decisions that are really going to affect people's lives. It breaks my heart that some people could lose services because of this when their children could really benefit.
Well, to be fair, I don't think that Dr. Lord and the expert panel from the American Psychiatric Association are using Benjamin Nugent as an example. I mean, that's sort of...
I agreed, but I think that things like that really feed into the conversation, and it ignores that there are a lot of kids out there who really need these services, who really benefit from them, and in tight economic times, this redefinition is absolutely going to be used to take services away from kids who could really benefit from them.
Leslie, thank you so much for your call. Elise Levine-Kenji, let me turn that to you, because it was only fairly recently, for example, back in late 2010, where Massachusetts became one of 29 or so states that requires insurers to cover services for children with autism. It's in our code of laws now in the state of Massachusetts. An enormous help to people, I'm sure. Maybe the insurance industry didn't like it so much. But that's one of the things I gather from Leslie's call that people are worried about, that if a new definition, narrower or not, pushes kids off the spectrum and they no longer receive the diagnosis, those services, that assistance, won't be there.
Well, also, to Leslie's point about early intervention, that's covered by the state. And she is absolutely correct that the earlier you get services, the more likely it is that children are going to be able to reach their full potential and so cost taxpayers less in the long run if we get the services in early and also help so the children can become productive taxpaying members of our society, and also to give these children a far higher quality of life. It's interesting that you bring up the insurance company. Missouri just released a report about their insurance law requiring insurance companies to cover autism. And what they found is that it's and it's been an increase 25 cents per member per month. So it is the way that states are going. And then the final point that I would say is that right now there is so many questions about whether autism is increasing or what the magnitude of autism is. And there are, the CDC, many agencies are doing epidemiological studies trying to figure out what the rate of autism is. So if we change the definition now midstream, we're breaking the chalk. Where's the continuity? Are we going to be able to track what is happening with autism?
Dr. Lord, I'd like to actually turn that to you because I think that's one of the more, that's like one of the 800-pound gorillas in the room here with this conversation, is that some 36,000 children a year now in the United States are diagnosed as being somewhere on the autism spectrum. You know, there are some studies that say 1 in 100 kids, the word epidemic has been thrown around a lot. So, I mean, is the update of the DSM in part a response to that, that maybe the DSM-4 was too vague?
It is not. I mean, it is a response to vagueness, but it is not a response to the increasing prevalence with the idea that we're going to cut prevalence. I think the goal and all the data, all the good data that we have seen, suggests that, in fact, by using this slightly modified approach, we can actually do a better job of diagnosing very young children, for example, toddlers. And our goal is the same as I think all the other people have raised, which is getting kids into early intervention and also doing a better job of continuing to diagnose people who are on the far other end of the spectrum of adults who need support but who have many strengths. I think the goal, though, is we can't diagnose everyone in the world with autism. So there have to be some limits. Mm. And there are limits. Four, take DSM-4 literally, which most clinicians do not, nor do parents. So my point is not that kids who have diagnoses shouldn't have them, but that if you just total up criteria, you can look like someone has ASD when they don't.
Dr. Lord, let me ask you, I just want to throw in one other question for you on this point, because, you know, we were talking about the study from Yale that had come out a little earlier. I understand that there have been two other field trials that have been issued around these new criteria. One showed a 1 percentage point increase in diagnosis rates. Another showed a 4 to 5% decrease. One of those studies was actually done here in Springfield, Massachusetts. Overall, I mean, do you sense that there will be some change in terms of how many children are diagnosed? There must be some change that will come with the new DSM-5.
Well, again, there may be some changes, but I don't think we can actually tell unless we take the DSM-5 criteria and try to use them to diagnose kids rather than taking old information mm-hmm. and trying to see how can we fit old information into the new criteria.
And how close is the new criteria to actually being part of the official DSM-5, which I understand is supposed to come out in 2013?
Right. I mean, we have a working draft. The working draft, they had field trials as part of the General American Psychiatric Association approach to DSM-5. And so what we're trying to do right now is just get information about those field trials, because in that case, the clinicians did actually use these criteria as opposed to take old data and try to mush them into the new criteria, which is where, you know, that's where we're stuck right now. Mm-hmm. We have old data, and we can make some inferences. I think what's important to realize is also that Yale study is not published. It was, you know, it was a statement by Fred Volkmar to a reporter related to, you know, it was, this whole thing has been handled in a very, very irresponsible fashion.
Well, but overall,
it was presented at a conference in Iceland.
And I'm going to have to jump in here, because I think the point overall is that there is some concern about what changes, if any, could have on families. And I'm very sorry, but we have to end it there for today. Listeners, there's a lot to say about this, so please do let us know what you think at radioboston.org. Dr. Catherine Lord, director of the Institute for Brain Development and a member of the DSM-5 Task Force, thank you so much for your time today. And Elise Levine Kanji, member of the Westboro School Committee and a mother of an autistic son, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, listeners, let us know, radioboston.org. Coming up, writer and theoretical physicist Alan Lightman reimagines the story of Genesis. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.